Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Here is the Disability Study channel in the New Books Networks. I'm Shuang. Welcome back to our podcast room. Today, I feel very pleased and honored to invite Professor Sarah Donthy to discuss her newest book entitled Disability in Contemporary China, Citizenship, Identity, and Culture. So again, the first thing I want to do, just briefly introduce myself as the host of this podcast channel. My name is Shuwan. I'm a PhD student in history at the University at Buffalo in United States, and my research mainly involved the history of deafness and disability in early 20th century China. So next thing I may want to introduce Professor Sarah Donthy to briefly talk about herself to us. Thank you, Professor.
Oh, thank you, Shuwan, and thank you very much for inviting me to this podcast. It's really quite timely as the book initially, Disability in Contemporary China, initially came out in 2020. That was during sort of the depths of the COVID pandemic, and that was in hardback. But now it's out in paperback. So, and just out in paperback. So this is fantastic to be able to have this opportunity to talk to you. To introduce myself, I'm a professor of Chinese Studies and Disability at the University of Nottingham in the UK. Sort of in terms of my history, I really am, I would class myself as a China specialist. I've been working and visiting and studying China for over 30 years now. I even started learning Chinese back in 1989. I hope that doesn't date me too much, but as we all know, Chinese language is very difficult. So I still feel like I'm learning it today. But I do like to use my knowledge of China and my ability to read and listen to Chinese and speak Chinese in a way that informs and I hope enhances the research that I do. My earliest research was about Chinese history and culture and literature. My PhD was set in the 16th century, so I'm a historian like you. One of the characteristics of my research, even though I'm now looking at more contemporary issues relating to disability in China, is that it is really strongly embedded and informed by China's historical progress and processes and understandings. So that's me. I'm really looking at disability in China, both historically and today.
Okay, thank you, Professor. Thank you so much for your brief talk of yourself and your research. So my next question will be, okay, I won't say most of disability historian may encounter, most of disability historian have experience of being asked by people like, why do you take interest in disability studies? In the academic work, it's still marginalized field. So why did you take interest in this field?
Thank you. That's a really good question. And actually, if That question isn't asked so much when I give talks in the UK or in in Ireland or in Europe or in the US. I think that question is, I'm asked that question most when I go to China or I speak with scholars from China or I do my research in China. And I think, unlike many people who do take up their research of disability from a very personal perspective because they themselves are disabled, I am non-disabled, but I do have personal experience of disability. And in the acknowledgements in my book, I spend quite a long time talking about my own family's experience with disability. My daughter has cerebral palsy. And I think that was really one of the triggers that sort of took, you know, as I was living with a disabled person and seeing the world both through their eyes and also through as a parent of a child with disability, I began to sort of to feel very very much I suppose the ways in which disabled people are treated, and this is treated in good ways, but also very commonly in bad ways, but often using vocabulary that is seen to be positive, but also can be very sort of marginalizing and demeaning. And it was those sort of contradictions in my personal experience that led me really to think about how I could draw on those understandings and take them to an academic level. And so what I did was I sort of began in the early 2000s to think about disability in China and try to sort of bring those two worlds together. And one of the first things that I did notice was that there was this massive gap, and really nobody was writing about disability in any substantive way whatsoever. There were some notable exceptions. I think Matthew Corman's work, he did some excellent ethnographic work on disabled men experiences in Beijing sort of around the sort of 1980s and 1990s. But beyond that, in terms of published works, there was very little going on. And so I felt there was an absolute sort of gap when we came to look at disability in China. And it's quite interesting because when we talk about disability in the UK, people are always talking about how much we need to know more, and there's such a big gap in it. But if you take it that to China, then, as I'm sure you already know, Shu, this is, you know, it's a massive field that really hasn't, we've only just started to scratch the surface. So beyond the gap, then, I suppose the next thing that sort of got me thinking about this sort of transition into looking at disability in China was the fact that the focus of people's work, those people who were looking at disability really were looking at it in very specific fields. And I'm thinking about disability, sort of disabled people's experiences in education, disabled people in social work and social care, discrimination in employment situations. There was some legal work looking at rights and other sort of legal processes. A few sort of semi-historical stuff and of course Corman's anthropological work. So there was another rather large lacuna in that we weren't looking at disability in China from a cultural or a predominantly sociological perspective. And I think that's really important because we can't really extricate sociology and culture, and we can't then look at all of these other ways in which disabled experiences happen in a particular cultural context without looking at culture and history. So my thought was somebody needs to come in and try to tie all of these various sort of threads together to try to provide some sort of overarching framework. Now, of course, working in the UK context or a Global North context, we do have some fantastically sort of well-developed and strong understandings of how disability is understood and experienced. And of course, the social model is one of the, I think, one of the greatest contributions of UK scholarship to the study of disability. You know, Mike Oliver's work and others who have taken that understanding that disability is created by social barriers and is not in, as a result of the fault of the individual in themselves. They've disentangled the relationship between disability as a social issue and impairment as a more medicalized and individualized issue. And so those things are sort of really important. But what I felt was, as people applied these theories that were developed in the Western context to places that were beyond that context, and not just China, but a lot of work has been done on Africa, South America, other areas around the world, but also even within Europe, it was quite clear that there was a disconnect between, although it was very helpful in helping us to see where those barriers and those sources of oppression were, whatever you do, it made both the context but also the people who are living through those experiences seem bad. I don't know how better to describe it, but I always felt that if I was going to use a social model and sort of unpick cinema or literature or policy, China would always come out bad, and it would also always come out worse than anywhere else that has had a longer history of disability rights and protection of disabled persons, livelihoods and opportunities. And that really wasn't what I was seeing when I was, or hearing when I was talking to people who were disabled in China, but also reading the works that they were producing. And what I was getting was a sense that actually a lot of their experience was very positive. And taking a social model and saying, well, actually what's happening here is really bad, seemed to devalue their experiences. So I wanted to think about how we could take sort of step back a bit and try to think a little bit more broadly about how culture, context, history, and contemporary policies and processes all combine, not necessarily in China but elsewhere as well, to frame and challenge strengthen, reinforce people's experience of what it means to be disabled in a particular context. So that was really, really why I thought about sort of moving into disability studies and looking particularly at China.
Okay, Professor, thanks so much for your answer. So I totally agree with you, because one thing you mentioned, importance of introducing, for example, Chinese cultural context and social context into the promising or expanding study of disability in the world. Because I'm also a disability historian, so I'm pretty sure I'm in agreement with you. I won't say in the field, general sense, the field of disability studies is still dominated by still Eurocentric, or much more precisely, it's very Anglo-American. So what it means that the most important framework and theory are created and contributed by scholars in America and the United States and the UK. So as you mentioned, maybe some framework created by, scholars studying America and UK may not really fit into the discussion of a representation and the perception of disability in the remainder world, especially in the global south. So Nathan, let's go back to your book. So another thing I noticed in your answer to my second question, is that you mentioned the two important issues. One is disabled people's experience with, discrimination. And another thing, you emphasize the importance of disability rights. So in my view, the two issues, they are both related to citizenship. And when I read your book, I noticed that the relation between citizenship and disability is one of the major concerns of your book. So I want to make sure, could you please briefly talk about, because as you mentioned, you're a historian, could you please briefly talk about the dynamics in the relations in the 20th century China?
Okay, yeah, no, that's a really good question, and thank you for picking up on that. And I like the way that you talk about the changing relationship and between sort of disability and citizenship, and I think it's really important to think about that. I think one of the major findings about, you know, in my research was that citizenship for disabled people has been very fluid and very dynamic and continues to be that. And it's and thinking about why we need to embed it in Chinese historical developments is really important too, because where I start the book, I don't go all the way back in history. That's what I'm leaving to somebody else to do. But I sort of start the story in the mid 19th sort of century, work my way forward. And why I've chosen that particular period was, I think, it's the time in which China transitioned from an empire to a modern nation state, and in itself was grappling with these notions about, you know, what constituted a citizen. We often think of disabled people as being marginalized within these broader discussions of citizenship, but actually what I found was that disabled people were almost drawn into these discussions about what made a citizen in the early days of the Chinese Republic, later on into sort of the Mao era from 1949 onwards, were really framed around the body and the mind, and not just any old body and mind, but essentially the ideal citizen was somebody who had was fit in body, fit and able in body, but also sort of healthy and in mind too. And I think it wasn't an obvious thing that disabled people were drawn into this discussion, but they then became very much affected by these discussions, and they were held up as examples of how not to be an ideal citizen, but also how to be an ideal citizen as well. And thinking back about why this period was so important, I think, for setting up what comes later, is the fact that The Chinese officials and leaders at the time were really grappling themselves with how to move beyond traditional ideas, and particularly those philosophical ideas such as sort of Confucianism in particular, which as we all know, was the idea, the thought that came in for most banging, really, you know. But Confucianism itself was really set the tone for how people who sort of inhabited non-normative ideals of physical and mental health should be incorporated or not into society. And I think this was really because of the way in which the individual was and their body and their actions were subsumed or understood through their functions. And this could be either through a social role or maybe through the way in which one conceived a civilized person. And in Confucian thought, that civilized person tends to be male, but I will leave it as ungendered at the moment. So in terms of the social roles, a person was a useful person to society if they could economically support their family or the broader clan. But they were also important to society because, and particularly the family and the lineage, because they could then bear children. So this bearing of children and offering economic support to that clan or familial structure were the core parts of people's social roles. So if you weren't able to perform those social roles, then what use were you to society under Confucian thought? And in terms of that, you know, if you had to be useful, but you also have to be civilized, I suppose with Confucianism, and there was this notion that you had to constantly strive to improve yourself, this continual striving to both improve yourself intellectually, but also improve yourself in terms of your relationships with other people, in both within your immediate circles, but also beyond. And that any imperfections in that air of civility that you cultivated within yourself implied vulgarity and imperfect, you know, sort of this imperfect, an imperfection of mind and body. So if somebody wasn't able to do these things, or if somebody was sort of even physically didn't meet the criteria of this perfect gentlemanly, to bring the gender back in, or civilized ideal, then they were deemed to be not useless or unworthy of being titled civilized. And what really happened at the end of the imperial period and moving the end of that period was Chinese traditional thoughts, this Confucian ideals, really came head, sort of met up with Western scientific thinking, that Chinese elites were grappling with themselves as they sort of transitioned to this new idea of a nation state. And I suppose more than anything, eugenics was one of those ideas that really almost complemented traditional Chinese thinking about what makes human quality, and the Chinese term suzhi, is really encapsulates this idea of there is something about humans that we can grade, and there are some humans that are better than other humans, and there are somehow we should actually try to improve humans so that they get to the highest quality of being human as understood of the day. Now, Chinese elites were really concerned about this because in order they'd gone through all of these traumas of the period, the Opium Wars, Sino-Japanese Wars, and China had been proven to be very weak in this regard, a century of humiliation. And this idea that China was actually the sick man of Asia and had to somehow cure itself in order to sort of restore its standing on the world stage. So, and lots of, both within China and outside of China, people would sort of look for evidence that China was sick somehow, either in mind or in body. And one of the one of the most interesting things that I sort of found as I was looking through those archives were the paintings of Peter Parker, who was a medical missionary down in the south of China, and they were painted as part of a project that sort of really enabled sort of almost visualized the tumors, the actual physical evidence, women and men with their tumors exposed, was physical evidence that China needed curing. And all of these ideas were then adopted by both the Communist Party and also the Nationalist Party as both then worked to try, sort of took on this idea that in order to be a useful citizen, you had to be healthy of mind and body.
Okay, thank you so much, Professor. I very appreciate your answer to my question. I think it's very interesting because I want to say your research on China may contribute some like very interesting thought to our debate about like something about like the able nationalist assumption in the definition of citizenship in a Western context, but I won't say, according to you answer, your talk, I won't say, the definition of citizenship and the relationship between disability and citizenship in China is much more, it's quite different from the same issue in a Western context. So my next question will be, because as I mentioned, your book talk a lot about citizenship. And when I read your book, I noticed that you use a very interesting term, very inspiring term. It's called para-citizenship. So could you please briefly talk about what is para-citizenship and how do you think of the importance of this kind of category or phenomenon in Chinese society?
Okay, thank you. Yes, I mean, para-citizenship, this concept was, as far as I'm aware, nobody else has used it in relationship to disability. It's been used elsewhere to describe people who, for example, migrant communities who have been left who've had a very sort of difficult relationship, shall we say, with citizenship processes. And I was inspired to use it because, as I said at the start, I was really troubled by the fact that every time I was looking at how citizenship was conceived in relationship to disabled people, that they were always, it was always positive, it was always presented as very negative. So, you know, we have semi-citizens, absent citizens, shadow citizens. All of these imply that disabled people are rather passive, or at least, you know, they're just, they're somehow not included in mainstream society, and they have no say in how they understand their activities. So I was looking for a term, you know, that would actually offer more of a spectrum of identity and belonging that could both cover those negative aspects. So, you know, the ways in which, as I've just mentioned, you know, broader, more hegemonic discourses about the body, the mind, ability, disability, were conceived at a sort of a more macro level, but also then, but how people then lived those experiences and understood from a very personal perspective and talked about, you know, how it meant to be disabled could also be covered within that. And I think combining citizenship with power is a really useful way of doing it, because we already understand power to mean to be associated with disability. We think about the Paralympics, for example, para athletes. And even within that, even the term a para athlete, there are the debates that both, you know, para athletes themselves, you know, see, draw great strength and pride from their ability to, you know, to apply, you know, do their work as athletes and be rewarded for that and their achievements. But, you know, there are critics that say, you know, why do we have para athletes? We should just have athletes. And they feel it's quite a disempowering term. So I wanted to have a term that could cover these debates and show that people could be both disempowered on one level but empowered in another level, and give and recognize that different people, even within the same context, could also have different understandings of that. And I draw a lot of my ideas from the academic research on cultural citizenship. My very good colleague here, Nick Stevenson at the University of Nottingham, is you know, has led the way in trying to talk about citizenship as a process that's embedded in culture, that we're all educated as to how to belong to society, but also it educates us as to who belongs in society as well, and the parameters for that sense of belonging, and so it enabled me to turn to the ways in which we should really try to imagine disabled identities, both in and through culture, and I think that's how the book came along. And I think language has a very important part to play there. And going back to sort of, you know, if we're looking at the historical trajectory of para citizenship in China, we see that, you know, from more traditional societies, the imperial society, sort of, and through into those early days, disabled people were described as fei wu, literally, you know, these as unwanted objects, rubbish, or the term tan fei, which is sort of broken and rubbish people. So they, or fei ren, you know, rubbish people. So from that, those understandings, they were then transformed through the Maoist era after 1949, and people were arguing, you know, that my evidence shows that people are arguing that actually you're calling us this, but this isn't how I feel. You know, I feel I am useful. I am disabled but not useless is the term they use. And they were very concerned about how to become useful to society. So this is a process in which disabled people themselves are active players. They have agency. They can choose to understand and react and negotiate and challenge these more dominant discourses of belonging, but also they can also find great meaning in it if they then understand where they fit. And I felt that we shouldn't apply, you know, value judgments to them. So, you know, and those conversations about how you describe yourself, what language you use, what language other people use, continued as well into the reform era and 1976 onwards. And we now know, you know, disabled people at this time, as China opened up to the world and started engaging with global initiatives from the UN and more recently from the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disability, the language is changing again. And we've gone from tan fei ren, you know, these disabled and not useful or broken people, to tan qi ren, which is a little bit more medicalized, but it's still tan, discarded and rubbish, plus ill or sick. But again, then it's transformed again to tan zhang, which is the zhang meaning a barrier. And so trying to employ those social model understandings, rights-based models, that disability is actually socially constructed and lived. And this has often been driven by disabled people themselves. And so I think, you know, they're trying to find meaning through vocabulary. They're contesting meanings that are handed down to them. And so paracitizenship is a fluid, it's a dynamic. We can conceive of it as a spectrum. It involves the state, it involves society, it involves historical and traditional understandings, but it also very much involves disabled people themselves and their emotions and the ways they feel about things. And I think that's one of the big things that the book brings out is the way in which people's voices and feelings about something can bring change, but also the ways in which governments and states also mobilize emotions to try to get people to do or behave in a certain way based on their own classifications of what makes somebody useful or not.
Yeah, Professor, thank you so much for your answer again. So I took some notes when I listened to your answer. I noticed that it's very interesting because you emphasize the changing perception and self-perception of people with a disability in 20th century China, with an emphasis on, I want to say, dynamic in the rhetoric and the discourse of the disability from canji to canfei to canzhang. So I want to say this issue is related to my next question. It's about representation of disability in media. So my next question is like, could you please briefly talk about the contrast and the similarity between the representation of disability in different type of media, such as novels and the movies in contemporary China?
Yeah, I mean, representation, I think, is a really interesting way of interrogating the ways in which those sort of dominant discourses are perpetuated and promoted, but also the ways in which people who then relate or watch those cultural forms and cultural medias, but also produce them themselves. And so this is one of the reasons why I chose to look at a variety of media as part of the book, because I wanted to see how those conversations were panning out in practice and over time. And again, it's very difficult to do things on a more longitudinal basis through other empirical means. And so I think, but before I sort of talk about those particular sort of cultural forms that I looked at, I think one of the things that I took forward as I started my investigation and sort of reading these different forms was the story of Zhang Haidi, and she is somebody who I've been very interested in for a long, long time. And for people who don't know about Zhang Haidi, she's somebody who is immensely politically powerful now. You know, president of the China Disabled Persons Federation. But when she first came to the notice of people in 1981, she was just a young girl. She was a wheelchair user. She had a spinal sort of injury, which left her unable to walk. But she was obviously extremely tenacious and had a very supportive family. And so living through the Cultural Revolution, she'd had to, really work hard to get an education. A lot of what she'd learned was actually self-educated, and through this she'd really made her name for herself locally, and she was and her story was picked up by I think it was the People's Daily and published, and her story really resonated with a lot of people at the time, because here we have somebody who traditionally was considered to be, I suppose, weak in body, but really strong in terms of her perseverance and determination. And what was what I feel is that she had. I mean, it was, she didn't start it, but she built on people sort of throughout the Mao era and exemplars and heroes who had overcome their disability. And I'm drawing on Mike Oliver's personal tragedy theory to explain how disabled people are seen to overcome their personal tragedy of impairment. And she really set up this Jiang Haidi effect, which saw people's understanding of disability as being something that could be overcome through either cure or rehabilitation, and was, if you didn't do it, then there was some sort of failing within yourself and there was something wrong with you. But it meant that combining the appearance of Jiang Haidi in the early 1980s with all of China's engagement with the UN meant the cultural forms and representations from this period onwards started to build on this narrative of, you could become equal, you could participate in society, you could share the bounteous joys of the new market economy and the sort of capitalist society with Chinese characteristics if you did these certain things. And it was characterized by what became known as the four selves. And the four selves were the Sizi, self-respect, Zizhuan, self-confidence, Zixin, self-improvement, Zixiang, and self-reliance, Zili, or self-supporting nature. So these four selves, you know, really became the core about how people, you know, should see their lives. And so what, you know, so people were expected, the rights were appearing in the laws and that, but they also, disabled people had a role to play as well. And I think this is what seemed to give people's lives values. So when it came to looking at the, all of this was in my head as I came to look at the various media forms, and I could see this playing out, this idea that disabled people, you know, and this was even, as an aside, this was even in films and works that were produced by disabled people themselves or had a sort of an intimate understanding of disability because their family family members were disabled. Was there something that the fact that disabled people had to draw on themselves and overcome their disability and or to avoid becoming an object of pity? The media also, for the most part, presented disability as undesirable, something to be feared. You know, the fact that you had to be tried to be as, and I'm using inverted commas here, as normal as possible. So still this idea that there was normality or a normative existence, i.e. non-disabled was the ideal, but somehow disabled people could get to it or as close to it as possible through somehow some endeavors. And so looking at Xie Jin's films Youth and Venus, Sun Zhou's film Breaking the Silence, Zhang Yuan's sort of pseudo-documentary sci-fi film Mama, all of these sort of cinematic, you know, really played on this idea about abnormality, searching for normality, also that, you know, that the somehow people had to overcome it and that there was something wrong with them if they couldn't. When you go into literature too, particularly in the early 1980s, there was idea about the fearfulness of disability, and I think, but also the fact that there were voices out there to be heard too. And I was particularly interested in the author Shitie Sheng, who himself is probably known as the most famous disabled writer in China. He's no longer with us, but his early work in particular was very much focused on his own disability and sort of trying to work through what that meant to him and how he could position himself within the society of the time. I mean, he often didn't write about himself. He used other characters, and so it's often had this sort of semi-autobiographical sort of bent to it. But what was interesting about Shitie Sheng's writing is that as he wrote about people like himself who were either wheelchair users or had physical mobility issues. It seemed to feel sort of more authentic. But as the further he strayed from his own experience and started to write, for example, about blindness, and this he does in Life on a String, which some people may have seen as a very famous film. He starts to move towards stereotype, and so. It's quite interesting that to me was quite telling, because it shows us that it is easy to revert to stereotype, and particularly if you don't know what you're talking about, but then even through those pieces about when people were talking about themselves and representing themselves, people spoke in stereotype too, and in these stereotypes and assumptions, and they sort of built that into their own identities, and either sort of, and oftentimes didn't even challenge the fact that the vocabulary they were using was actually reinforcing the discriminatory attitudes and stigmatizations that they were facing in their everyday life. So it was really quite interesting to see this playing out through different authors and through different media across those things. I mean, bringing it up a little bit more to date, one of the most interesting novels, again, which has now been made into a film, was Bifeyu's Tuina, or Massage, as it's been translated, also, which looks at the massage industry and how sort of blind people are funneled into an industry that has been for many years assumed to be something that blind people are good at, because obviously they're saying that the narrative goes, if they can't see, then they must be good at something else like touch. So they must be good at massage. And so there's a whole industry that's sort of serving disabled people, blind people. That's built up in China, and people are funneled through the education system to do this particular job. And another one is a piano tuner, you know, or piano player, something musical, because again, if you can't see, then you're assumed that you have your auditory your auditory skills are compensated. And so, you know, I would encourage people to have a, you know, read Twain Hour or watch Massage, because it really, it starts to challenge these notions that disabled people all want to do these things and that they all subscribe to these stereotypes about them. And one of the most powerful characters in the novel is somebody called Du Hong. And she spoke, her story really spoke to me, because through her story, she realizes that, you know, she knows very much she doesn't want to be a masseuse, but she has a skill at piano playing. And she realizes as she's paraded out in front of a non-disabled audiences that she's there to make them feel better. Her impairment makes non-disabled people feel better about themselves. And she says there are some phrases. She talks about how she realizes now that she was in debt to non-disabled society, to the able-bodied society, and somehow she had to do stuff to pay off this debt. She didn't know how she got into this debt, but she was in it, and this is the way she had to pay it off. And this idea that disabled people are perpetually living in debt to non-disabled or able-bodied society, I think is really, really interesting. And I can see that coming out in all of these cultural forms, and it's part of this needing to overcome to become useful. A useful member of society, coming in from wherever else they've been marginalized and excluded from society, and brought back into mainstream society. They overcome their disability through either physical or mental means, cure, rehabilitation, whatever it is, to pay back a debt to society to become useful once again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Professor. Thanks again for your answer. So I really appreciate you talk. I mean, you're both a researcher and you talk here about Zhang Haidi, because I think I remember her very well, because I grew up in China in the 1990s. When I was a child in elementary school, I learned Zhang Haidi's story.
You learn about Zhang Haidi. Yeah. I mean, impossibly. The quite interesting thing is Zhang Haidi was never meant to be a model for disabled people. Zhang Haidi was meant to be a model for non-disabled people, for the young people. So, you know, so I think everybody knows Zhang Haidi, and as you know, whether her story speaks to them or not is a different matter. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like you, I really appreciate that you use the term like model. I want to say like she was described in my memory. She was described as a model citizen in Chinese. I mean, public education. So and I want to say. Well, now I reflect, I mean, as a disability historian, when I reflect on the narrative what I learned when I was a child in elementary school in China about Zhang Haidi, I won't say the narrative now I take a critical reflection. I won't say the official narrative is about her. I won't say it's a fraud with, I won't say, overcome and normative narrative. Promoted by the able-bodied authorities and the so-called mainstream society. But another person I really appreciate that you mentioned is Shi Tiesheng. I really like, I'm a big fan of him, about his writing, about his experience as a disabled people, which is very, very interesting for me, especially as a disability historian now. But I want to say his book record much more about experience of disabled people in Chinese society and his encounter with difficulty, with discrimination, whatever. It's quite different from the official narrative of like Zhang Haidi Chinese textbook. So I want to say, so it's related to my next question, because I think at the end of your book, you talk a lot about the life writings composed by people with disability, and you emphasize the difference between their own narrative and the so-called public imagination. I want to say public here refers to able-bodied people. So could you talk about what's the difference between those life writing and the able-bodied imagination, able-bodied people's imagination of disability and disabled people?
Yeah, no, thank you. I think, I mean, one of my earliest encounters with disabled experiences in China was through life writing. And it was through the story of Zhang Haidi, obviously, but also another young man called Zhang Yuncheng. Now, he's now written two memoirs. He's the first one of those is 3 days to walk, which in Chinese is Jia Ru Wo Nang Xing Zou San Tian. And his second one, which was published in 2003, and then his second one was Flying Without Wings, Huan Yi Zhong Fan Shi Fei Xing, which was published in 2012. And I was really interested in Zhang Yuncheng, because I mean, first of all, he's a young man, and I have a lot of interest in how, you know, gender plays a role, you know, in you know, we think about gendered identities and how that sort of intersects with experiences and other aspects of people's lives. And so thinking about how a young man like Zhang Yuncheng, you know, could wrote a story about his experiences, and it was really nice, because I felt I could hear the frustrations of a young man coming through his memoirs. You know, he was bitter about the discrimination that he faced. He was acutely aware of the stigma of having a disability, but through it all, he still had hope. And he, you know, the way he sort of tried to think about how to achieve his dreams was really, really interesting. And a lot of books written by people like Zhang Yuncheng and others have when I went to sort of buy them in the bookshops, it was quite interesting, because they weren't in the section you would think they were in. They weren't in the section which was, you know, biographies and memoirs. They were in the section, the self-help section. So these were books that weren't being seen as autobiographies, memoirs, life writing, in that sort of way. They were being promoted as self-help books. And so I could see there was a very close link between the writing of disabled people offering some form of inspiration to their able-bodied readership. And again, this is probably who these books are primarily aimed at. Now, Jang Yun-chung was the first, but became part of a stable of young authors, and not so young authors, who were promoted and encouraged by an editor, Jang Da-nor, who had what he termed a self-help project. And basically, Jang Da-nor, who himself was non-disabled, would go around and sort of collect these disabled young people and writers and encourage them to write. And, and he's got a whole stable of books that have been published with, with his support. But all of them have these characteristics as well about, sort of the reflecting on the sort of the real problems in their lives, which are often very are omitted from the more official narratives promoted by the state, because the state doesn't want to tell people how awful disabled people's life can be in China today. That's they want to show that the people have got through overcome their problems and they're living the good life now. Well, these people aren't, and they haven't been, and so understanding how their lives, them telling their own lives, albeit with a great deal of help from Jang Da-nor, who in his own words is often very encouraging for them to tell the darker side of their story, because it would probably sell for a start. But at least we get to hear those stories now. I think it's very interesting, because what they do as part of this telling the darker side is they often focus on what I describe in the book as their troublesome bodies. They themselves are frustrated by their existence, and they themselves are, finding it hard to find meaning in the society, which is telling them both at the one time that, they're equal and they have rights, but at the other hand, that they clearly aren't, because they aren't getting the education, they aren't getting the employment opportunities, they aren't getting the marriage opportunities, all of those, the good life as promised under neoliberalism. So it was thinking about how they went through this way of exposing their disability, their impairment, to public gaze, to both tell their own truth, but also to attract a readership. And so there was this very interesting link between disabled writers themselves, their experiences, and their non-disabled readership. And so this is very much what we talk about as the able-bodied gaze. And in a way, they're responding to what they think their non-disabled readership would want to see, but it's part of also them being necessary to tell their own story. And and often this becomes much more acute with female writers. And it was also a really interesting characteristic about the story of Jiang Haidi. So if you compare Jiang Haidi's story to all the other male stories, the wounded heroes, etc., they all talked about their disability, but they didn't talk about the most intimate nature of the disability. So, for example, with Jiang Haidi, we hear about her incontinence. We hear her body is almost exposed to view. We're told about the fact that she wasn't able to have sex with her husband, and all of these sort of these things that really expose the female body to view. And this also happens much more with female writers as well. So the public is imagining, the non-disabled public imagines a weak and vulnerable female troublesome body, which becomes a sort of core of a narrative. And with one author, her name is Yin Shujun, and her memoir was entitled in English, A Showdown with Death, Dui Jue Sishen, which was published in 2012. She spends chapters and chapters talking about her troublesome body, and she calls it her troublesome body too, exposing all the most intimate details to public view, but as a part of saying, look, this is my life, and this is how I've needed to come to terms with the fact that I was made disabled later, became disabled later on in life, I wasn't born with my disability. But it's all about then again paying back debts and seeing that you then have to find a value in your life and do that. So my thoughts on this were that all of these people, these real people that we're talking about in these memoirs are telling a story about how they successfully navigated themselves from a position of weakness to a position of strength. And this has been then used to inform and educate disabled people about how to be a good power citizen in China, but also it informs the broader public, the non-disabled readership, about what it means to be disabled and how they should think about it. So that is how it sort of feeds into that public imagination of what it means to be. So it almost reinforces people's fear of being disabled because they have these troublesome bodies that are, you know, are often painful, cause them all sorts of anxieties and limits opportunities, which of course we know structurally is society itself, but this is how it's presented in these works. But also, I think it often it's seen as an inspiration. So if people like Zhang Haidi, Zhang Yuncheng, Yin Shuzhen can do it, and they're disabled and they have all these troubles, you know, I too should be able to manage my own problems. So this is why, you know, a lot of people, critics, have talked about inspiration porn, about how disabled, you know, we are not, you know, Stella Young has famously talked about, you know, I'm not your inspiration porn, and you shouldn't use my experience to you know, and you know, watch me do everyday tasks and wonder at them, and wonder how I could do them in my disabled body. You know, that's not how it should be. So, but it's how these people have made meaning of their lives. And so this is why I'm sort of bringing it back to this idea of paracitizenship, is we need to understand that people can only make meanings of their lives within the messages that they have received from society. They have agency in it, and they can negotiate and they can challenge it themselves. But this culture surrounds everybody. And it's only when things like aspects punctuate this environment of disability and understandings of disability that we get change. And so the Convention on Rights of Persons with a Disability has forced the Chinese state to think about how it sort of articulates rights of disabled people and makes disability work a priority. Although even then, you know, and that has also then stimulated disabled groups and non-governmental organizations to sort of try to rethink how they can also fight for rights. But it's quite interesting, you know, still, even with very clear guidance from the CRPD about how we should understand disability, and it really isn't about being situated within the individual, it's based on the social model, and that, you know, structures of society are the barriers and the oppressors. Still, the law on the protection of disabled persons in China still reiterates, alongside rights and dignities, it still reiterates that disabled people should be understood as people who have lost something, or they cannot perform activities that are considered, and here I'm quoting again, normal. So they're still articulating disabled rights vis-a-vis this ideal that of a non-disabled person, of an able-bodied person. What's even more interesting, I think, is in Article 10, and going back to the point I made about the four selves, these are actually written into Chinese law, and I'll just quote it to you, because I think it just really tells us something about it. It says, disabled persons should display an optimistic and enterprising spirit. They should have a sense of self-respect, self-confidence, self-improvement, and self-reliance. So those four, zhe zun, zhe xin, zhe qiang, zhe li, and make contributions to the socialist construction. So within law, they are told that they have to be all of these things that we've been talking about today, which non-disabled people are not told by law that they have to do. So I think it's absolutely fascinating. I just hope that, you know, it's sort of provides some inspiration for people working on other contexts, or even within the UK and US, to sort of think about how we need to understand this sort of very fluid, dynamic world of paracitizenship and how it works. But that's an example of how it works. I think it works in the Chinese context anyway.
Yeah, thank you so much, Professor. One thing I want to say, I noticed that one of your main points in your answer is disabled in terms of their life writing, Chinese disabled writers, they couldn't avoid, use the phrase you used, couldn't avoid the public gaze or able-bodied gaze. And I want to say female disabled writers' situation may be worse, like Zhang Haidi. They couldn't avoid, I want to say they are victim of both able-bodied gaze and male gaze. And in the second half of your answer, I think interesting because you mentioned you return to the issue of parasitianship. I want to say it's very interesting because according to in my understanding, I would say, I can identify the similarity between the neoliberalist definition of disability. And like a post-socialist definitions of disability in China in the five self, and the common ground of the two types of definition beyond the ideological boundary is that they both emphasize overcome narrative. Second thing, they emphasize they want to make disabled people usable politically or economically useful. Well, that thing is very neoliberalist understanding disabled people. Well, it's very interesting. So last question as you discussed briefly in your second part of your answer to my last question, let's go back to the parasitianship. I think at the very end of your book, you talk about the perils and the possibility of parasitianship. So could you please briefly talk about the perils and the possibilities?
Okay, yeah. I mean, I think the way to answer that is sort of twofold. I think, first of all, is, you know, for disabled persons themselves, you know, there are certainly, you know, any ways of belonging and discourses of belonging hold both perils and possibilities, regardless of where the context is. But if we understand it through the perspective of parasitianship, we can see that this spectrum allows them to have or allows us to understand that what might be limiting or a problematic for one person in one particular context might not necessarily be seen or experienced or understood as that in another context. So in itself, we have to understand that people, one situation for one person may be a possibility. I can see how I belong, whereas for another person who's educated and informed by a different cultural context could actually say, well, actually, this is extremely discriminatory and oppressive, and we need to talk about, you know, we need to talk about this. So in terms of the perils, really, what I can see is that wherever disabled people are, they, and particularly in the Chinese case, they are, we can understand it as the place where dominant understandings and rationalities meet the body. So for the Chinese case, we've got socialism plus a huge dose of neoliberal rationality is a sort of meeting somewhere around the disabled body, and disabled persons are the people who are sort of having to navigate their way through all of this. And we can understand that. So they will then have, they will then get potentially locked in to a set of sort of assumptions and stereotypes and ideas, which is very difficult to get out of. And so they may, in fact, start to reinforce the very things that they set out to dismantle in the first place. And of course, I'm sure Zhang Haidi, as she was being feted as a model citizen, thought she was doing a great deal for advancing the rights of disabled persons. But actually, by, creating this narrative, it actually may have set back disabled rights and opportunities in for the longer term. And I think, hopefully that will change. I don't know, but so these people are seen as successful. They've done the successful navigation, and so disabled people can see the possibility of changing their lives. And so, you know, broadly, it might be that they are set back in terms of how you know, how broader non-disabled society and the structures of society and policies and governments, you know, look at disabled persons, because they're not directly challenging the root of the oppression that they face. But still, they see the possibility of actually being of value to society and being of use to society and being back in mainstream society. There's a lot of talk about, you know, return to society, you know, pay back society, be of value. And so it seems like an avenue of opportunity. So that's why I'm sort of thinking about perils and possibilities. In terms of the second way is thinking about for academic inquiry. And I think what I was, again, going back to the point I made at the beginning, is I'm sort of trying to think about the ways in which we can understand these seemingly contradictory and complex things that are going on underneath underneath everything. And it's not, there isn't a consistent narrative that everybody is understanding. We're all, not everybody around the world is working to the same principles. But if we think of citizenship as something that affects disabled people, that they are often passively engaged in, but sometimes actively engaging with, the fact that it can be imposed, but it can also be negotiated and challenged, all of these things, and that it's not a consistent sort of understanding that if you say this, then it's bad, because some people in certain societies might actually think it's a really good thing and will help them in the short term, although it might even not be in the long run. So yeah, I think there are perils and possibilities both for disabled persons and also for academic inquiry in thinking about para-citizenship. But what I'm hoping is that, you know, taking the learnings from the social model and the human rights model and all of these other models that are actually, you know, working to ensure people have rights as well as responsibilities, and that's, I think, the Chinese case has proven there are a lot more responsibilities than rights at the moment, that spectrum, you know, China will move along that spectrum so that disabled people are granted more rights without the responsibilities that come with them. Whereas at the moment, I think it's more a sense of responsibilities have overridden the rights section of it. So that's my view of para-citizenship and how it might be changing it in itself, and depending on context and time and place.
Okay, Professor, thanks so much for your answer to my last question. So at the very end of our talk today, I want, again, as I always did in my episode in the past, I may recommend the audience of our podcast to read, to buy a copy of Professor Sarah Dunsey's newest book, Disability in Contemporary China, Citizenship, Identity, and Culture. It's published by Cambridge University Press. So thank you so much to listen to our talk, about Professor Dunsey's talk about her fantastic book about disability in contemporary China. So have a good time. See you next time.
Thank you.